May it please the court, this morning my name is Greg Cavanero here on behalf of the appellants. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. This case involves the appellant seeking a non-exclusive right to access their property over the platted roadways of the Chautauqua Beach plat of 1888. Those easements consist of access over 77th Place and 81st Avenue. Those access points were already being used and were subject to litigation by the respondents previously.
Counsel, let me ask you some questions about, based on a review of the record. In your complaint to Quiet Title, you're seeking easements over property owned by others, correct?
Yes.
And that property is also subject to deeds of trust, presumably securing loans to those property owners, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the basis upon which you named the parties was a litigation guarantee, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. In your complaint, I don't see any requests to challenge the validity of the deeds of trust by the various defendants. Is that correct?
That's also correct.
And in the complaint, there's no request to challenge the priority of those deeds of trust.
That's also correct.
So as I understand your claim, that if the trial court had allowed the quiet title action to proceed and you received an easement, that easement would still be subject to those deeds of trust held by the various lenders?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct.
That's basic mortgage law, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. As I'm sure the court is aware, the appellants did bring a motion to serve the parties, the lenders who had not been served. They were named, but they were not served by the previous counsel involved in the case. Each of those lenders was served, and each of those lenders opted to dismiss itself from the case. Those motions were brought primarily in August of 2013 and were granted by the trial court.
Why was it an abuse of discretion for the trial court to dismiss when you didn't serve all of the parties that were claimed to be necessary parties? I mean, the court provided a last chance, a three-week window, and you didn't get it done.
Well, I did get it done. I served
on
all
time.
The lenders. I was, excuse me, there was a six-day lapse in between the time that the order required the service and the fact that the service was actually done.
That's so correct. Why is it an abuse of discretion for the court to rule that if you can't follow its orders and comply, it can dismiss the parties not served?
Well, I think that that the proceeding is equitable, and the court needs to look at whether there's an alternative to dismissing the case with prejudice. For example, dismissing the case without prejudice, or requiring further proceedings or even sanctions. If the court wanted to sanction me, for example, for being 6 days late when the case had already been proceeding for 806 days, and no one seemed to be in a hurry to get this case resolved. But if, in fact, the court believed that it was my behavior which led to those defendants being served late, I would gladly have accepted any sanction the court would have deemed acceptable. However, it's punitive in the fact that it dismisses with prejudice my client's case, who now have landlocked property which they can't access. And I think that by failing to serve defendants within a six-day window of the time that they were required to be served didn't affect anybody's rights. And I think that could have been dealt with in another fashion by the trial court.
Well, as I understand, the complaint did allege that this was a easement by necessity for landlocked property, but rather you made a different claim. Isn't that true?
The claim was made to access by means of the platted roads, the property owner, yes. Right, that's right.
So even with the dismissal with prejudice, you have a remaining claim for an easement by necessity or not?
That would not be my position, no, Your Honor.
Why not?
Pardon me?
Why wouldn't an easement by necessity claim still be available?
Well, I believe that the summary judgment would have precluded the parties from bringing that claim, Your Honor.
How so?
Because it was implicated by the lawsuit that we filed that there was an easement necessary and that...
Well, you were claiming there was a plat and that by virtue of the dedication of the plat, your client had the right to use that portion of the property identified as a road on the plat. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. How would resolution of that adverse to your client preclude a separate statutory claim for a way of necessity?
It's possible that we could have moved forward that would push back the entire time clock for a period of a year or later or even greater to bring this claim.
Well, since somebody's in a hurry, why would that matter?
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Wendy Lyon of Riddell Williams here representing Respondent School Employees Credit Union of Washington. The other respondents are represented here today, and they join in this argument. So essentially before you today are two questions. One, are lenders necessary parties when they have a deed of trust and therefore have an interest in property, and that property is subject to a quiet title action? Yes. The second question is, did the trial court abuse its discretion when it issued the various orders that gave appellants chance after chance, and yet appellants didn't take advantage of those chances?
What's the prejudice?
To
your client.
Well, one, this case has now been pending for 4 years, and we have a...
Not much of a burden if he's not doing anything.
Yes, but I think in all, our judicial system is set up to adjudicate issues with a relatively efficient manner and allowing cases to drag on for 4 years or potentially even longer does result in some prejudice to the parties. And I don't know if you were asking what's the prejudice of not having these other lenders as part of the case? Or?
Well, I think the next line of questioning is, why are the lenders necessary parties? The dispute is over platted easements that were not part of the original properties on which presumably they issued their mortgages. There's nothing in the record I saw that indicates that anything had been remortgaged. So we're talking about quieting title to an easement, not exclusive property. And I think as Judge Cox has asked, the questions about priority aren't being affected. What makes them necessary?
That's an excellent question. First, what makes them necessary is that there's certainly quite a bit of precedent that says in quiet title actions, all parties that have an interest in that property are indeed necessary parties. So that's just established.
That's a too broad a statement, counsel.
Okay.
If, for example, you as the holder of a deed of trust get a title report that says there are delinquent real estate taxes on property that's subject to your deed of trust, do you name the county as a party in a foreclosure action, notwithstanding the fact you cannot affect their priority?
That's an excellent point. So let's also take another example where you've got a...
Answer my question first.
I would think that's an option in that case. So I agree
and
with
to what purpose?
Because the party, so let's assume there's a foreclosure action and there's delinquent tax lien on the property. Whoever takes the property will take it subject to that action, and therefore that person's interest will not be affected. In a situation as here, it's possible that where you don't...
Why would you join the county then? You said it was optional. If you can't affect the county's interests, why would you ever join them as a party to the foreclosure action?
Well, it depends on if they're junior or senior. If they're...
Well, how would real property taxes ever be junior?
Well, they won't. So in that case, and I was going to follow it up with an example of a second lien holder foreclosing, and that person could foreclose subject to the first lien holder, just as it could foreclose subject to the taxes.
Well, counsel, let me just focus on necessary party language, and that's Civil Rule 19A. And in your brief, you quote that and emphasize the second part of that. And it says that a necessary party is one who claims an interest relating to the subject of the action you certainly do, as a lender.
Correct.
And is so situated that the disposition of the action in his absence may, as a practical matter, impair or impede his ability to protect that interest. So my question here is, why do you qualify under that language? Specifically, what does this quiet title action do that impairs or impedes your ability to protect your lien?
We have two possibilities. Either this easement is going to be granted over property that a lender has security interest, and certainly if that is the case, and if the lender then would be subject to that easement, you can understand how that would impair potentially his
security
interest.
Well, counsel has already acknowledged in response to my question that he's not challenging the priority. So the property that would be the easement would remain subject to your lien, and you have a prior interest in that property.
Exactly, which is an excellent point, because now let's take the circumstance where the lender then forecloses on that property, and I think we're taking the hypothetical here where then that foreclosure would not be subject to the easement rights. And that
would extinguish the easement.
Or would extinguish the easement rights. So
that
now
seems to be the concession.
Now we're creating instability of title. We're creating an inefficiency of judicial resources.
But how does that impair the bank's interest?
Because the bank has an interest in having everybody, or at least our judicial system for certain, has an interest in having everybody that has one of those property sticks in their hands all together in the same action. And the bank's interest in that, or the various lenders here in this case, have an interest in not re-adjudicating this issue multiple times.
What issue would be re-adjudicated?
There's
an acknowledgement that they, lenders, have a priority interest and that the easement would be subject to that priority interest. So what has to be re-adjudicated?
Whether or not, I would imagine that if appellants are able to establish their easement rights over parcel A, we have several parcels here, right? So let's say A, B, and C. So they've got easement rights now over A, B, and C, and they have their access to their property. Well, parcel B in the middle now has a lender that forecloses, and all of a sudden we've got part of this easement that doesn't exist anymore because they foreclose, not subject to those easement rights. So now you've got this, now you don't have access to the property. I would imagine that appellants would then want to reestablish their easement rights over parcel B. Let's assume they do that. Well, now parcel C gets foreclosed, and we just have this problem continuing on indefinitely.
So how does that affect the bank who foreclosed against parcel B adversely?
Because now they're involved in litigation over and over again, potentially.
Presumably they would sell the property at a foreclosure sale.
Or they would take the property, they would purchase it themselves.
And then in turn sell it again?
Potentially, but then the litigation, we don't know when this litigation is going to occur.
Is there any evidence that the existence of these easements significantly or materially impairs the value of the security of any of the lenders in this case?
That issue was not raised, but I would submit that procedural due process requires that a person with an interest in property.
You're not answering my question. My question is there any evidence in the record that there's any material impact on the value of the security held by these banks if the easement rights are established?
In this particular case, I don't know. That issue was not reached. You can certainly imagine circumstances.
Would you show that before you could show that the bank was impaired or hindered in this lawsuit by the relief granted if plaintiffs succeed?
No, I think CR-19 takes care of that because it says if you do have an interest in the property, you're entitled to be part of the action so that you, as the person with a property interest, can decide that.
What about the words impair or hinder? Aren't they in that same court rule?
Correct, but you don't.
Could you address how they're impaired or hindered? Absent a showing of material decline in the value of the security if the easement's granted?
I think that goes back to what we were just discussing, is that it potentially leads to litigation after litigation, and certainly every party has an interest in not becoming part of multiple lawsuits.
Well, in this case, if our decision was that the lenders weren't necessary parties, there isn't any chance of subsequent litigation, is there? Because they're all bound by the creation of the easement.
If they are not necessary parties, would they be bound by the creation of the easement? I guess that goes contrary to what the concession was earlier.
Well, the streets were platted, so they weren't part of the lot property initially. They were
correct.
The property was gained in those lots, presumably as after-acquired property by the recent vacations. And now
correct.
Those vacations have isolated two lots. So now we're saying, well, they weren't part of the property when it was mortgaged. Oh, through vacation, now they maybe can be added to those lots. But putting the easement back is somehow materially putting the lender in a worse position?
It potentially could because we don't know what that easement does. Now, after those platted roads were vacated and became annexed to the other properties, I can't tell you, standing here today, how each one was used and how an easement over that.
Why aren't you the party that has the burden of making that information part of the record before the court determines that the lenders are indispensable or necessary parties? Without that information, how could the court determine that they are?
Because with as holders of a deed of trust, which is an interest in property, the court rules clearly state that they are supposed to be part of that action.
What case says that?
I believe on page 19 we cite several cases.
I know the cases you cite. They don't say that. So tell me what case you're relying on.
Well, I'm relying on the cases on page 19, which indicate that in quiet title actions, lenders with deeds of trust are necessary.
Okay, let me ask you this question. It's the law, essentially, that a necessary party and an indispensable party are not necessarily the same, correct?
Correct.
In order to be an indispensable party, you first have to establish that you're a necessary party. And this case was based on a dismissal that said that the lenders are indispensable parties, right?
You're drawing on my memory here. I don't know if it said indispensable or necessary.
Okay.
But we would request that the court affirm the trial court's orders in this matter. Thank you.
I'd like to make a few brief points. The record does not reflect, nor was there any evidence presented that there would be any kind of impairment of value based on the appellant's action to the collateral of the lenders. Secondly, I think that the lenders, by voluntarily dismissing themselves from this case, in effect waive any argument that they are now bringing, that they are somehow impaired, that the collateral is diminished in value, or that they were, in fact, necessary or indispensable parties in this case. None of them wanted to be involved in this case. As a matter of fact, they even wrote this court and said, we were not submitting a brief. We don't want to be involved.
Notwithstanding the fact that you initially named the lenders, you would have no objection to them being dismissed as defendants, would you?
I did not object because I maintained that they were neither necessary or indispensable parties.
Not with saying the fact that your predecessor named them.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. I have no further comments. Or have any questions? Thank you.